I'm Eunice Scoife, and I grew up in Seattle and I'm currently in Edmonton, Alberta, where I've been for the last several years writing with a vengeance, or as often as I can get away with it, which has been full-time the last 2 years. I have also been reading Canadian fiction quite extensively because I'm concerned about putting together two anthologies, at least two I've got designed that I'd like to propose to publishers in the States of Canadian writing, and Seal Press in Seattle I'm seeing before the end of August, sometime during August, because I think there's so much fine Canadian fiction that just isn't getting across the border. So I'm a bit evangelical about that. But it also ties in with multiculturalism this week and the last week, that I'm asking you to look, of all the directions you've been looking in, all the different places you've been looking, to look north at Canada and some of her fiction. And the collection I had put together to look at included looking at the different religions as they show up as an influence in the stories, not as the subject, not as a documentary, but as a background, as an influence, as perhaps a source of conflict amongst characters, or a source of motivation, or however you want to see religion. I found an astounding number of stories amongst contemporary writers, and I limited myself to things that have been published in the last 10 or 15 years. We had one on Monday, which was called Shades of Sin by a woman writer in Winnipeg, a Mennonite writer, a Mennonite background. And this one is, in German, is the way she originally published it, Das Engelein kommt, and I thought perhaps we'd put up her English translation for the board this morning, The Little Angel Cometh. This story is by Gertrude Story, Storey. She has two volumes of stories out. Characters in her stories are very often connected. She's not going in a linear kind of development where she's taking a character from childhood up to adulthood, but you'll find characters surfacing again. In fact, what's interesting, I find, about this particular story is that she's written this story more than once. She's written this story from the point of view of the narrator you'll hear today, and in another collection of stories, she comes back and does it through the neighbor's point of view. And it shows up in one more story as an event. You know, it's not the main story, but this event is alluded to. One could deduce from that it was, in fact, a very major, real event, but we wouldn't do that. We would assume this is fiction, and she's just letting fiction take its course. You get your hand slapped if you make assumptions that this was a real event in somebody's life in studying fiction. So we won't suggest that. But the power of this incident in her writing is obviously considerable. German Lutheran background you'll hear reference to in the story. You'll probably be able to date it. I'm asking you to look for when, I mean, just for the sense of the story, sort of when this takes place. You'll have to forgive me. I will be reading it because we don't have copies or procedure or an anthology where we could get it to you in advance. And hence, I hope you can manage an oral tradition today. It actually lends itself, I think, to an oral telling for a number of reasons. There's a sense of elevated significance about the story, and when you're done, it's one of the things I'd like to discuss. What elevates this event? In what way has it been made of great significance to the narrator? There's also a sense of distance in the sense of this happened. I want you to hear it, and then I want you to hear it again tomorrow. Well, you know, in actual fact, she's done it in three stories. I want you to hear it again. There's a sense of her having to make meaning. I have to make sense of this. And I think you'll hear signs of that in the telling, the degree to which the narrator has to make meaning out of this. There are events in our lives that defy making sense out of, and they defy making meaning. You can hear the narrator fighting to impose some kind of order or reason on this. And hence, all of those things, I think, lend itself to an oral telling. So the fact that we have to have it read today may be the right thing to do, is to read this particular story out loud. Any questions before we begin?
How long is the story? I have to leave.
Will I get to the end? I'm starting straight away today, Rolf, so that it's longer than the other one, and I'll give you the copy if you have to. We've got about six pages here. Now that's put everybody off, you see, because they think, oh, six pages.
I'll get it to you.
I don't
know.
Give me your six pages.
Okay. How old a person is the author?
At the time of writing, She was perhaps 55, I'm guessing, at the time of writing. In Canada, she's a legend in that, I don't know if I should tell you this or not. I suppose I don't have a choice now. I shouldn't say legend. Gertrude, as she's fondly called, went to a writing community in Saskatchewan called Fort San, S-A-N-N. Or Emma Lake. There's two writing centers. Saskatchewan has been absolutely phenomenal in supporting the arts. If you really want to sit down and write for the next 5 years, you go become a Canadian, preferably Saskatchewan, and you'll have, for $40 a week, can go to the writing communities. Wonderful, wonderful support from the government. Just phenomenal support. Alberta is almost up to that. We have subsidized writing communities where we'll go for 5 to 10 days. But Saskatchewan beats us all to pieces. And it's shown up. They've got a tremendous number of writers, and I'll list a few when we're done. She went to Fort San, which had been previously a tubercular sanatorium, or torium, I never get that right. Anyway, for tuberculosis patients, and she became in contact, shall we say, with a previous resident, now dead, whose name I think was called Letitia. And Gertrude has been in contact with Letitia since. I mean, she lived apparently in her room. And there are people who were there when she first heard Letitia. And Gertrude would fit in just fine at Holden. She'd be comfortable and relaxed and be there for coffee and enjoy the sessions. But if she heard Letitia, that would take first priority. And that is a voice that she claims is influential on her writing. So she's as sane and hale and hearty as you can find. But she does have communication with Letitia at Fort Sam. So everybody's got a different version of this. The night that she first heard Letitia, the Edmonton version is the most authentic and best. If you want the best one, come to Edmonton. All right, Das Engelein kommt. When my sister Elsa was a baby, she was an angel, and my father called her Das Engelein. At our house, people never spoke in German. My mother would not allow it. Only my father ever did. Is this on? Oh, then I'll sit down.
Wherever you want.
I'll sit down. I don't want to be watching it. My mother would not allow it. Only my father ever did, and we children could hardly understand him. It was the fury of his life having non-German children. One of his furies. He had several. The Brotherhood of Man was another. My father loved the Brotherhood of Man with an ardent, vocal passion. He loved his daughters too, I suppose, but they never knew it. He loved his son, and his daughters knew it. He loved him like Isaac loved his Jacob, or like Abraham his Isaac. My father never sacrificed his Floydie on any altar, never even tried to, but he killed his daughters 1,000 times over. And this is to be the story of the last time he killed my sister Elsa in her snow-white Engelein gown, her wings spread and ready to soar at the church Christmas concert 1 year in the sandy, dry, hard farming district where we used to live. It had to be in German. That whole church concert had to be in German. Some of the kids did okay. They had mothers who hardly spoke English, and they'd learn German. In that community, the fathers went out into the world and did the business and learned to speak the language of business. The mothers stayed home and plucked geese and made quilts and pierogies and babies and crooned them to sleep with Komm Herr Jesu and sent them there with a few slaps to the ear if the child went unwilling. So it was at our house, too, except for the German and the Jesu. My mother didn't believe in either one. She had a different at home. Her father was just as German as anybody else in that settlement, but his mind had a different order. His daughter was to go to normal school and be a teacher, but she chose Papa instead. No wonder, I suppose. Papa was tall and beautiful and imposing, and he courted every woman in the district atop his large white stallion, taking them for rides into the hills to show them the wood violets. I think the violets stopped when my mother agreed to come into his kitchen, but his passions did not. At least I knew we had violin and lots of talk and booming laughter when the neighbors came, but cold lips and steel blue eyes when they left again. It was a hard life in a lot of ways, but this is not that story. I tell it to you this way, though, because it is very hard, at 50, to keep the story going well, to keep the order. I've had too many other voices inside my head for so long, and Papa bellering from his bed after Mama died, and the third white stallion through him, bellering for beef and tea broth, and a pen to write his newest order down. Papa was a difficult man. He lived for too many years. I looked after him for 23 of them. Mama, I think now sometimes, almost had it easy. She spoke back, you see, and the hate did not gather, black and hard and festering, around her heart as it did mine. But I want to tell you about Elsa. This is the story about Elsa. I think that is what Elsa means me to do when she comes now and stands by my side when I am writing away the blackness and drinking the coffee Papa forbade in this house because it repelled him. Elsa has been dead 41 years now. I counted it out today, and I suppose she has forgotten how to speak. On account of not knowing the sacred German language, ha ha, I never believed that. Papa used to say it was all in German up there in heaven. A German pastor once told him. For all those years, I was careful not to care. But now I see that Elsa did not even go there. She couldn't have. The church says not, and they should be right on some things at least. It's too terrible otherwise to try to live if they're not. But all those years, I thought it was an accident, and I'm sure Papa did too. But I think Mama knew. I do not want to do the thinking sometimes. There is danger in thinking. But I think now Mama knew because it raised a real uproar the way she went to bed after it and stayed there the day it happened and wouldn't even get up for the funeral. But that's ahead of it again. I need order. It's harder than to have it in your head and know it, this setting of it down, in order. Once I wanted to be a writer and I read King Arthur over and over again. Until I knew the order of telling things, but now I cannot keep it straight. It goes like this, though. We always went to church, all but our mother. Papa said we had to go to church and learn the glory. It was not safe to live in this world otherwise. And the glory was only good if it came in German. It was the holy way. It was important because it had to do with Christus and the angels and your holy German soul. The words you spoke in the old tongue, he said, helped to get you the glory. That pastor, I knew him. That pastor said so, and Papa believed him, but Mother didn't. She said it was a peasant's attitude, and it was either all true in any language, or it was not all true, and maybe none of it true, and so what? It didn't put bread on the table. But you sure couldn't break it up into German God, an English God, and French God. It wasn't logical. And Papa said what was logical was if she would allow his daughters to speak German at the supper table. But the Schroeders seemed to be such English bootlickers, it seemed to be more than a man could expect to have the old tongue spoken around his own fireside. She wouldn't let anyone speak around her fireside, not German, would she? And our mother said, seemed to her, it was her Schroeder money bought the coal to keep the fire going in it. And Papa said, yes, yes, rub it in. And he took his box full of blue socialist tracts and saddled his white stallion with the red, red wild eyes and rode to Elmira Bittner's to discuss the brotherhood of man. And Mama would scrub hard at the fading red apples on the oilcloth at the kitchen table and make mouths at the way the corners were wearing through when she'd say, come on, girls, we'll make brown sugar fudge tonight. And our mother made brown sugar fudge with butter and walnuts most nights. He went to Elmira Bittner's to discuss the brotherhood of man. And sometimes when my sister Elsa peered too long into the night from the kitchen window, straining to see his white stallion coming back out of the dark night, my mother would say, don't be silly, girl. Do you think a bear will get him or something? He's only gone to get educated. Come on, and we'll make ourselves some popcorn. But Elsa wouldn't. Elsa just turned her back on her mother and went and rearranged Papa's pipes neatly beside the family picture, taken when there was only Papa and our mother and Elsa and me. Because our sister Laura already lived just at Grandpa Schroeder's, she had to. Papa said she was not his child. I hope this is the order of the story. That seems to fit here. Laura's important. She got lost in a different way. And while Elsa looked at herself being an Engeline in the family picture on the sideboard, our mother and I would pop popcorn, shelling it first, plink plank into a pan off the cob, and heating the heavy frying pan on the back of the stove while we did it. Not Floydie, though. Floydie was a boy, and anyway, he was young and fast asleep by that time of night. But Elsa would only pick away at her bowlful now and again, and when Mama said, "Come on, eat up. It's just the way you like it, Elsa," Elsa would get that tight look around her eyes and say, "No, I'm saving mine for Floydie." And Mama would say, "He's spoiled enough." And Elsa would say, "You don't like anybody, do you, Mama?" And she'd go back to the window and look some more for Papa and his stallion, and she only left her place when Floydie cried, and then she always ran to him before Mama could go. And yet Floydie was the reason, I don't care, why Elsa had to look out into the dark night for Papa with her pink barn goose eyes that got teary from too much watching. And Floydie was the reason Grandpa Schroeder got so mad he kept giving our mother money to buy us girls new dresses for the school picnic and the church concert. Floydie was Papa's sunny boy cereal, and Elsa used to be his Engeline. But now she was just a girl who had grown a long Schroeder neck and couldn't do arithmetic. She couldn't learn her German piece either. For the church Christmas concert, you had to learn to speak a piece in German, no matter what. You had to, or your folks were shamed forever and ever. Even my mother went to the church Christmas concert. It was called the Tannenbaum, and nobody missed going. It was holy, and not even the littlest ones expected to see Santa. It was as if to say the white light of Jesu shone those nights. The church was lit with candles. Not even the coal oil lamps were lit, and certainly not the gas mantle lanterns with their piercing twin eyes. Only candles were holy. And that year, that last year, Elsa said she wanted to be an angel. An angel in German yet, and with 28 lines to speak. When Pastor asked who would take the part, Elsa's hand shot up, and it surprised me. Elsa was not that way. She would rather not speak, even in English, and to do anything in German killed her. Especially speak to Papa. When you have been an Engeline and aren't any longer, to stand before Papa and say, "Ihr Kinderlein kommt," zur Bethlehem Stall, into his pale, slow eyes, doesn't help to make the wings grow. And if you are one to have had the wings clipped, you know this is the right order to say it. "Kinderlein, not Kidderlein," Papa told her. "Bethlehem, not Bethlehem. What do you want to put a th in it for? The people will think you're not raised right if you don't speak right. Now start the first verse again from the beginning and stand straight and speak it right, Elsa. 28 lines only, a big girl like you, and you can't even learn it?" Papa would say. Helsenzendem was the word that did it. "Helsedem," Elsa said. Well, who wouldn't? It's hard in German to get all the Z's and N's and R's in, and lots of times the Germans don't even care when they talk it. But when it comes to their kids, watch out. They're supposed to all speak like preachers. I talked German in my head all the time. Nobody knew it. One of the voices in my head was a German man, and he told jokes sometimes in German on the pastor when church went on too long. "Here is mir ein Alterfart," he'd say sometimes. And I would try not to smile. To smile was dangerous. And the voice would tell me to go look up fart in Papa's German dictionary when we got home. But we never touched Papa's books. That was dangerous too. And I would have if I'd wanted, but I didn't want to care about it. Elsa cared too much. It was dangerous. Day by day she sewed on her Engeline costume, looking quite often at the picture on the sideboard. She sewed in the parlor where you weren't supposed to use thread because it worked itself into the carpet. Mama told her she could sit there when she caught her sewing at 4 o'clock in the morning once by the kitchen lamp. Its flame flickered pale and yellow. "Silly goose," Mama told her, "it's too hard on the eyes, and I could do your sewing on the machine in a minute." But Elsa only turned her back on Mama, pretending she was looking for the scissors, and said, "I want to do it myself." And then she'd show Papa after supper how it was coming, and he'd say, Oh, yes, yes, Elsa, but you're not going to spend your life in a dress factory. How's the peace coming, the peace you're supposed to speak? And then Elsa would quickly stand there and speak, one angel wing drooping from her costume. Beides likelines hell's a dim, she'd get to, and Papa would look up quick and say, hell's lads, hell's lance, put the Z in it, how come you can't remember? People will think you weren't raised right, Elsa. And then he'd turn away and call Floydie to him for a game of clap handies, and Mama would come from the parlor door, come work in the kitchen, the light's better, Elsa. But Elsa would take her piece out of her apron pocket where she kept it to learn even in the toilet. I saw her once. And her mouth made the words, but she did not say them out loud. And she watched Papa and Floydie whenever they laughed. Until Papa said, you could likely learn better in the kitchen, Elsa. What are you doing here? And then she folded her piece up and put it in her pocket and left them. And on the Tannenbaum night, she spoke it pretty well, so I don't know why Papa had to do it. The candles were lit in the church, and you could almost smell the glory, and people shook hands with everybody they could reach, even after they got sitting down in the pews, the fat ones straining hard over their chests to shake with one sitting behind them. This is obviously passing the peace in the German tradition. Grown-ups even shook with two-year-olds and graced each other fröhliche Weihnachten, whether they were mad at each other or not. And you could smell the mandarin oranges from the brown paper bags, each one packed two man's hands full of peanuts and almonds and striped Christmas candy made into curlicues, almost the size and shape of Floydie's new bow tie, and each one with two oranges at the bottom so that you had to dig through all the other good stuff if you wanted to eat them first. One thing, Germans never were stingy when it was nuts and candy and they had the money. Only we were never allowed to open our bags until we got home. In our family, we were never allowed. That was Papa's way. You weren't supposed to look anxious. It meant you weren't raised right. That night, we girls were wearing our new dresses Grandpa Schroeder had given the money for. And Floydie looked like a prince, true enough, like Papa said, in his royal blue breeches and snow-white shirt with the ruffles. And Mama looked nice and came along to the concert, and people graced her too. And only a few made remarks like, well, at least we see you at Christmas. So it was all good, very good for once. And Elsa spoke right up, ihr Kinderlein kommt, only with not enough Z's and N's in it. But she spoke clear and good, her eyes shining and her hands folded and looking up into the candelabra so that her eyes got to be two candles too. But the trouble was, her one wing drooped because she would not let Mama help her sew. And Mrs. Elmira Bittner said afterwards to Papa, now, Floydie, you tell that wife of yours I got time on my hands. I could help her next Christmas with the kids' costumes if she wants. Fix the wing just right, you know. And Mama was standing right there beside Mrs. Elmira Bittner. And Mrs. Elmira Bittner turned to her next and graced her and maybe never even knew her because Mama hardly ever came to church. But Mama said later that Mrs. Bittner did know her. And Papa said it didn't matter, why worry about a little thing like that? The point was people thought his kids weren't raised right. How come she let the kids show up with a costume like that? It wasn't the first time either. We were on the way home then, and the horse's hooves sounded crisp crunch on the hard-packed snow of the road. And the traces jingled like bells, although Papa wasn't a one to put brass bells on the harness like a lot of men did. He said it was frippery. And I tried to think hard about the oranges and how they'd be when we got home. And finally Papa would let us open our bags. I had to think hard about them. To think about Elsa's drooping wing was too dangerous. But when we got home and Papa had carried Floydie inside and us girls and Mama had our coats off, Elsa wouldn't even open her bag. And Mama was undressing Floydie, fast asleep on the kitchen table. And Mama had one eye on Elsa, sitting silent on a hard chair by the Quebec heater with her piece in her hand. And Mama looked real nice, very nice. She hardly ever dressed up. And Papa came up behind her, his fur coat and hat still on, because he still had to go out and do the horses. And he laid his hand on Mama's shoulder and said, it's always better after church. and he showed his hard, white, even teeth under his silky, smooth mustache. He was a very good looker, always. And Mama just picked Floydie up and walked out from under his hand and said over her shoulder, Elmira Bittner has lots of time on her hands, I hear. And Papa turned quick to the door and stepped on the paper bag with the costumes in it. I guess I should not have left it there. And he kicked at the bag and it split. And the Engeline costume got tangled in his church overshoes, and he grabbed it and threw it in the corner and didn't even bother putting on his barn boots because he knew he wasn't going to the barn, I guess. And he drove out the yard, and the harness traces clanging no rhythm, no whatsoever rhythm, because the horses were going too hard, and it was cold for their lungs to go hard. Like Grandpa Schroeder said, Papa was not much good on horses. And Mama came out of the bedroom and picked up the Engeline costume and said, Never mind, Grandpa said you looked real pretty. And Elsa grabbed the costume out of her hands and scrunched it all up tight and held it to her and went to the window to strain her eyes into the night to see Papa going. And there was no moon. And that night, before Papa got home from Elmira Bittner's, Elsa took the key to the box stall and went into the stallion. And Papa found her when he got home. And afterwards, he would not even sell the stallion. And when we moved to town a little later, because Grandpa Schroeder said so and even bought the house, Papa kept the stallion at Elmira Bittner's and went out from town Sundays to go to German church and ride his snow-white stallion. There, the words are said. The words of Elsa's dying are now said. The words are in order, I think, and it does not seem too dangerous to have them down on paper. And Elsa does not speak yet, but I somehow think now the words are all in order. If I just sit here, if I do not rearrange them, if I think very hard on Papa, Elsa finally will nod and go. Well, there's probably two ways you can take that. Yes, I think it went very quick that she raises that. There's probably two ways we could look at that.
That may have been an oldest child before they got married, or...
That's one way. What's another?
That the mother had an affair, and which I doubt sincerely.
Who said it was not the mother's child?
The father.
The father. So the daughter, the narrator says that the father says that this was not the child. Is the father, would you consider the father reliable?
No. Except for I could not see the mother having, the picture I see of the woman being, never going out of home, I could not picture her having a child while they were married. That's the reason I raised the question. Mm-hmm.
I read it as how is the father construed this? If it was before they were married, he insists that the child live in town. Well, I suppose if that could be the case. But it seems to be another possibility.
He was just terribly, terribly jealous.
Yeah.
Did I just interpret this this way, or was that the third child? I thought she said that was when there was just my sister and me.
And then Laura. That would rule that out.
Okay,
yeah.
then
you're right. Yeah, I forgot that. But it was.
But then she didn't live with the family the way it sounds.
No.
I assumed it was the father's child. But that the father, there was some characteristic in the child that the father rejected. And so he's accusing the mother of having had an affair, even though she would never do that.
Mm-hmm. Probably
and so,
because it was female.
Yeah.
The third female.
Third.
The third female. Or it had the too long Schroeder neck, or it had, you know, who knows what. I mean, this father was so arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. I certainly assume it was his child, but that for whatever reason. An accusation to make her guilty of something allows him to be more guilty, does it not? I mean, he establishes that. Okay. Other points? Questions? Yeah?
Just a comment about, I guess I grew up in an area that experiences within the Lutheran Church, that German upbringing and the German... philosophy. I don't have to be German. It's a broader area of Europe than that, I think. But within the church, I do think that that's the relationship that many of us have had modeled in parenting of fathers to daughters, especially. I don't know how much broader than that, but I think that this story is good.
What did he want from the daughter?
what you seem as wanting from.
Well, I guess the thing that I saw was perfect obedience and absolute. I mean, her arranging his pipes, and she was to do
everything
to serve him, almost a servant relationship. Go ahead.
Oh, the daughter reflected. The daughter was an image of him. He was concerned about proper raising. Wasn't raised right. And if she's not raised right, then it's going to look bad for him.
They're extensions of his pride.
Right.
When we lived in North Central Minnesota, predominantly German farming communities, and part of the area the parish would serve, was still struck that girls in households were encouraged not even to finish high school, and this is only 10 years ago, that there would be a son whose academic potential was obviously less than the daughter's, but he would get the money for the tech school or for junior college or college, and what a waste. But the daughters, if they were, you know, to take interest in a boy at 16 or 17, it was good, you know, it was okay to pursue marriage. In fact, by 18 or 19, you really ought to do that. And I remember talking to home ec classes, you know, family life classes, the unit, and invariably, you know, sophomore and junior level, and they're out of a group of 12 to 14 girls, four or five already married, some child without being married, but you know, someday would be, and very bright potential. And I just remember the utter waste, but I also remember the very definite German holds that many of them came. It is good to hear Grandpa Schroeder, the liberator in there, who felt much differently. Because that's not, you know, we shouldn't stereotype, because there are, you know, a lot of bright rays in there too. But I remember the oppression, and that's not, you know, too terribly long ago.
What do you hear from the other daughter? The narrator is female. Mm-hmm. The way in which she tells the story circles or leaves her in a position which is less integrated than the view and the vision we get of Elsa.
She has a detachment, it seems, with Elsa staring out the window waiting for the father to come back or watching him leave, that she doesn't have, and she seems to acknowledge that herself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The thing that I gathered from it, however, was she talks about the blackness and the bitterness that surrounded her heart because she didn't fight back.
Yeah.
And that into her adulthood, apparently, as she writes this, she recognizes that her experience was in some ways more damaging, more killing than, maybe not more than, but equal to Elsa's.
Yes.
Or equal to the child that was rejected and sent away. All of them died as a result.
Yeah, she says at the beginning, do you remember, he killed his daughters 1,000 times over, and
yeah,
I'm telling you about
right.
The last time he could
yeah.
kill Elsa. She's still in the process of being killed over and over,
yeah.
is she not? I'm hoping this time Elsa will let me go. What does she mean by that?
Not, if I think upon Papa, Elsa will find me not and leave.
Yeah.
And I wonder if she's not feeling a lot of guilt because she didn't stand up for Elsa. I get that feeling that for some reason that figure of Elsa standing next to her gives her a feeling of guilt that maybe Elsa would still be alive, or maybe Elsa would have survived better in the short time she had if she had stood up against Papa and said, hey, she's doing the best that she can. She's
all right, or intervene somehow, even that last visit to the barn. The words at the end are, the words of Elsa's dying are said. They are in order, I think. It does not seem too dangerous to have them down on paper. And Elsa does not speak yet, but I sometimes think, if I just sit here and do not rearrange them and think hard on Papa, then she will nod and go. What's dangerous about the words, and why must she think hard on Papa?
Sometimes it's easy to ignore the hate that you have built around your heart until you have to see it in words. or put it down, to really formulate it and say with your mind as well as your heart that it is there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scary, because you have to face it then rather than just ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she's afraid of lightning bolts coming out of
mm-hmm.
the German
mm-hmm.
heaven.
She, how old is she when she writes? Sorry, go ahead.
She said she was 50. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But until she can let go of the hate for her father, she can't let go of Elsa either.
Right.
And she can't get the glory.
Still looking after the glory, yes, to get the glory. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And does the Lutheran tradition allow you to feel a hatred toward your father?
Very risky.
Yeah, very risky.
For sure.
I was just going to get the actual age of... She said, for so many years I've been trying to get it.
Well, she said she was 50.
She says she's 50, but then how old was she when it happened? And that
she
is given.
She's been 41 years, I think.
You got 41?
Okay.
Yeah,
died.
So that it's 9 that she's
watching.
Yes, it's almost, when she says, Elsa will nod and go.
Yeah,
what is she nodding to? I will nod and leave. I won't ask that my story be told anymore.
To resolution.
Some resolution, some justice, some justification for what's going on. But the notion of Elsa waiting, waiting, waiting. I think of what I told you earlier about Gertrude
yes.
claiming a voice.
Yeah.
You know, this was written before that experience. It's interesting, the notion of presence.
Yeah.
The presence of somebody else.
What do people think Elsa is waiting for? Is it for her story to be told somehow and to be put down?
Can find
yes.
peace. I think once
yeah.
it's told, maybe she can find the peace to resolve and to continue on with her life.
What's the ambiguity about the death? What are the possible stories that came out of this? And this is why I think Gertrude's written this 3 times. I mean, what do we know happened? Or what do we know happened?
I assume she froze.
Right.
I assume
it's
she was killed by the
yeah,
stallion.
That's another...
She says, and afterwards, Papa would not sell the white stallion.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think the horse maybe killed him, but I think she froze to death in the barn, waiting for him to come back from one of his educational trips.
But then, what would be the reason for selling the stallion? I think there has to be something to do with
yeah,
the stallion.
There has to be, with
has
the stallion.
To be some connection.
Yeah.
Well, they're mean in the stall. You don't go
did
in
she go in to wait for Papa, or did she go in to destroy herself? Is another question.
Did she understand what was that? How conscious of she would she be? And yet, it could be very deeply.
I don't know, that imagery of her clinging that garment to her, you know,
yeah.
as if you know I blew it. I'm, you know, my worth is just on the ground.
That
by keeping the stallion too, it's almost like an extension of himself. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, they say he killed his daughters over and over again, if the stallion indeed was involved then in her death, even the fact of his keeping it was a lack of acknowledgement of his own destructiveness,
mm-hmm.
and holding on to that in a really strange way.
You know, the guilt that the writer is feeling, you question whether anything that she could have done would have done any good, because... The Elsa would not allow any. She wouldn't allow her mother. She probably wouldn't allow the sister to help her either, because it was a relationship between herself and her father. She felt this rejection because of the younger brother. She had probably gotten some attention from him, you know, before.
What's her relation to the mother? The Elsa's. You know, yes, there's the competition with Floydie, perhaps, or the boy can do no wrong. But what's her relation with the mother?
She's rejecting the mother, though, too, because she feels that the mother is rejecting the father. She's blaming the mother for the way the father acts. To a certain
she didn't
extent.
Seem to have much respect for the mother either.
Mm-hmm. But she sees the fact that he leaves to go to this other
and
place
why does
as the
he
mother's
leave?
Fault.
In Elsa's view, I mean, how is Elsa atoning for her mother, or making up, shall we say?
She's trying to be friendly and pleasant and...
To please.
Mother
I'll speak
does
right,
in
I'll sew right. You know, she doesn't sew properly and Bittner notices it, so the daughter's going to try to sew and obviously fails enormously.
Mm-hmm.
I'll speak properly.
Going back to the theme of Elsa's death being unfinished, or her presence being there, it's interesting that the father's injury causes him to be... paralyzed or incapacitated, or it isn't too clear if he had a stroke or was injured. and he was as if dead, but he was still there and requiring care.
Yeah. He lived too many years.
Was he alive, or had he just died shortly before this was written? Because she cared for him 23 years after the mother died. So the possibility that he might still even be alive, or just recently died, and this is
I think the narrator has chosen to make him, and I don't think for a moment we can take this as anybody, you know, the narrator is author, and the author's actual writing this after death. I don't think you can do that for a moment. I think she's chosen to create in fiction after the death, as if this is part of putting to rest. The father's burial requires the burial of this, or the setting to rest of this, I think. Is the sense. He's certainly dead at the telling of the story.
He had lived too many years.
Mm. He'd lived too long.
She says that Elsie's death is a suicide. She says, in heaven, Daddy says in heaven you gotta speak German. Oh, but that's right, Elsie won't be in heaven because the church says if you kill yourself, you're not in heaven.
You're buried outside the gate.
Actually, that's very interesting, Ingrid. I haven't read it that way. But the church says that, and they must be right about something, she says. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right.
Does it say how old she was when she died, Elsa?
For those years, I was careful not to care, but now I see that Elsa did not even go there. She couldn't have.
Go there, meaning heaven.
Heaven. The church says not. Well, this comes right after. Papa used to say it was all German up there, a German pastor told him. And then the narrator says, ha ha. The church, she couldn't have gone. The church says not, and they should be right on some things. It is too terrible otherwise to try to live. What an incredible tension between I need to believe some of this and I want to reject all of it. The church says this, I'm going to choose to believe that, even if that means, if that's, this, that's very interesting. I read it quite differently.
The reason Elsa can't go.
Yeah. Which makes more poignant this, Elsa will nod and go.
But maybe that's part, maybe she's trying to get the words down right.
So that Elsa will be saved.
Mind sort out what was going on there.
So that it wasn't Elsa's suicide, it was Papa's murder.
Right.
You know, actually, she comes out with this very strong
beginning.
Right.
The story in the neighborhood, of course, what is it? He kept it at Elmira Bittner's. I'm sorry, where is it? She would not go to the funeral, is what I'm looking for. Right at the end.
That's right at the beginning. The mother didn't go to the funeral.
No, the mother didn't go to the funeral. What the neighbor said, you know, you don't get their interpretation, whether it was the cold, whether it was being brutalized, or whether it was the word suicide used.
She said that the mother wouldn't go to the funeral, went to bed and wouldn't go to the funeral. Okay. And the neighbors were gossiping about that, and the implication was because the mother thought this was murder.
Mm-hmm.
I thought. Mm-hmm. But then she sort of stumbles across this thing of Elsie being committing suicide, taking the key, going to the Stallions. And then I think the whole tension in the story is re-saying it so that she can get to the place where it was murder and not suicide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Describing the months of that child trying to please her father and working on that outfit at 4 a.m. You know, that child really trying, so focused that she couldn't receive comfort from her mother, who was quite gentle with her, and her sister, who was quite positive to her. She was so focused on the father.
But how typical of human beings. You know, I mean, so many of us would act the same way.
But without the relation between the father and the mother, I think the child wouldn't be understood. The desperate need to please.
But I mean, we do this in our own relationships so often.
Yeah.
That's a really wonderful way she gets at the difference between the mother and the father when he goes off for his sessions. She makes what kind of fudge was it?
Brown sugar
fudge.
Walnuts.
Yeah, but she has such a delicious sense of humor in the story like that.
The details of the narrative.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. The choice of details, I think, are powerful. When you've got a story with the drama of what's coming, there's an understatement. You know, she works in circles at the beginning. It takes about 3 pages. This is a story I'm telling. She gives you a little bit of something else, but this is not it. And when you actually get to the end, I think it's most powerfully shown when you get to the end, and there was no moon, and that night before Papa got home, Elsa took the key and went into the stallion, and Papa found her when he got home. And afterwards, he would not even sell the stallion. She still hasn't said Elsa's dead, though you know from the from the beginning. It's a restraint in telling that I think is part of the power of Gertrude's writing.
That one phrase, went into the stallion, I don't think I heard that as clearly as just now as you read that, you know. It is a powerful...
As opposed to just went into the box and waited, did.
The stallion being the sort of ultimate male image.
Yeah, that horse image, the stallion.
And went into her is a very biblical expression for sexuality as well.
Yeah.
I thought the tension between the writer, I mean the importance of writing, of getting of setting the words straight, of getting it in order, was such a compelling sort of sub-theme that...
Isn't that, though, part of the German culture, the order, the way things are to be? It's like she had inherited a part of it that she hated the most. And again, I guess that's part of the tension. But
I think if the order is being emphasized because of the German culture, it's a parody then. I must make order, I must make order. It won't do any good. It's not going to resolve my hate and anger and hurt. It's not going to bring her back to life. She says there's order in the writing, in the art. Mm-hmm. Of making it order, but it's not going to restore to life, is it? I think you might be right. I think she may be playing off that notion of order a lot.
I just felt that real strongly because of the German families that I've known. Mm-hmm. It's like every woman raised in a German home that I'm aware of is rejecting the order of that she was raised under, and yet all of them are fanatics, you know, in a sense.
What's interesting, we've said this before, but the narrator doesn't get away. You know, the detachment of the culture, of the thing she's... But she's there. She's the one that's cared for Papa, and she's the one that's at the end telling the story. Maybe telling the story is the one that gets away. I'm not sure. Maybe there is that distance possible when the story is told. This is when this is told again, one of them is the church service, in which I think it's Elmira Bittner is asked to sing O Holy Night or something like this at the funeral. If you haven't read this one before you read that story, it's a devastating discovery because then towards the end of the story you discover what she's singing for and what part she had in the drama. There's two stories. I can't give you the names. I think it's Turnstone Press in Winnipeg. Turnstone. And both of Gertrude Story's books are out from that press.
Turnstone
is one word in Winnipeg, and I would think the best thing would just be you can nag your local bookseller, which I think you all ought to do, the Turnstone Press, and to order them for you. You should be a story, S-T-O-R-E-Y. I have, and is there other things you want to say about this? Is there anyone that wants to make a comparison to this and the one on Monday, when we had the mother who was helping the girls grow up in ways that were forbidden by the community, and this mother who seems quite crippled, though she's been given the avenue, exit, the possibility of an exit, seems to be, at least in the telling of this story, quite impotent to influence her daughters in ways that are life-giving. Did you feel that? You know, as if she's overwhelmed by the kind of conflict that she's involved in. Whereas the mother in the Monday story, that lovely indirect way of saying there are other ways and there are other worlds.
Well, in the Monday story, I think the mother was in control of her life. And in this one, this mother was completely subjugated by her husband.
There doesn't seem to be the conflict, as much of a conflict between the couple.
in that story as there is in this one.
Right.
Or at least it isn't on the surface.
Right. Actually, we didn't have a father even shown, did we? But the mother seemed to be able to come up with means of connecting with her daughters in ways that are devastating here. I have, if you like, and this is optional, a few other writers whose work is not dissimilar in terms of issues and origins and culture, first what I call first and second generation conflict. This notion, I felt you smiling every time, and I did too, because I know God spoke Norwegian.
Danish?
I'm sorry. That period of time, you know, when religion equaled ethnic community, I find just fascinating. The way in which the religion fostered the or protected and depended on an ethnic community, and which ties right into what we're talking about, multiculturalism. There was a time when the church was the place to protect the culture. And there was a time when the culture could not have been maintained as strong roots without the church. And that has to do with you know, what I call first and second generation. In the writing I'm doing, I telescope time, and I call it first and second generation, but it isn't always first and second, is it? Because I'm working through two generations in the writing I'm doing. The one that's quite integrated and immersed, where ethnic and religion work off each other, depend on each other, protect each other. And then the next generation, where we take our religion into the outside world and discover that it doesn't depend on being Norwegian to be Christian, you know. At least some people think it's not necessary. I run into these people once in a while who still really do believe that national origins have to do with heaven's destination. You know somebody like that? And that's what we're talking about in multiculturalism. But when it shows up in fiction, and I think Canada's writers, because of difference in history, not because of anything else, but the writing is coming at a time, and the writing surfaced, I think, really flourished in, say, about the mid-60s, there are still that shift between first and generation to be written about. Whereas I think it's a bit further past for us, if I'm not wrong. I don't know why this is the case, but it becomes my top-of-the-line question that I ask constantly fiction writers or people in the two places. Why is there so much fiction dealing with this first and second generation regarding religion and ethnicity? And where is it in the States? Where can I find it in fiction for this country? And I may be wrong. Maybe it's all sitting there and I haven't found it. Do you want a few things to refer to in Canada? Do you want,
sure,
like a little bibliography?
Yes, I will.
There's about five writers which, if you're interested in this issue, deal with it in ways that look exactly like home, you know, wherever home is. Small town, Nebraska, Minnesota, Pennsylvania. This is optional. No, I'm not assuming you're going to go out and read the rest of it. Margaret Lawrence is, if you were going to make biblical equations for our writers, she'd be Ruth, I think. Isn't Ruth just about the most honorable, upright, loyal, good woman in the Old Testament? Well, Margaret Lawrence would be Ruth. And she writes from Manitoba. And she has written about five novels. She died 18 months ago, and she's instant sainthood in Canada. She's a wonderful, wonderful person and writer. She's written about five novels, and they've all used the same characters. And the delight is read one novel, and you discover the next novel, one of those characters is picked up, and she takes that one. So once you get going, this will keep you going till Christmas, if you're The Stone Angel is her most famous. It's so famous that people who teach Canadian literature, or Can Lit, as we call it, think, you know, oh dear, I've got to teach that again. Maybe it's the For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know, it shows up on every 1920s fiction in the States. The Stone Angel is set in Manitoba, is that notion of Vanessa, the young girl, and the Presbyterian settlers of her ancestors. The Stone Angel is the angel sitting up in the cemetery that marks the graves of her ancestors, and how the child... No, the Stone Angel... Sorry, I'm mixing two books up. The Stone Angel is an old woman, Hagar, who is facing her death, and you get the flashback of her whole life, and she's a wonderfully bitter, self-righteous, proud woman whose pride becomes ameliorated in going through... And she runs away from home as well. I think it's probably the first runaway for a senior that we had in fiction. Wonderful, wonderful story. The Stone Angel, there's something called The Diviners, which is her last book.
forwards and backwards in time. She's done something wonderful with time, something wonderful with mother and daughter. There are no archetypes in my mind that really do the mother-daughter story. We've got Hamlet and his mother, that's mother's son, right? We've got Oedipus and his mother, that's mother's son. I don't know any archetype that does mother-daughter, except a few from ancient Greek myths. There's one that comes close to in The Diviners. Wonderful book. The one that I like the best, I shouldn't say the best, the one I'd recommend to you the most, Bird in the House, is a collection of stories. In Canada, I don't know exactly if this fits in American writing right now, but we have collections of connected stories. So that The Bird in the House is about 8 stories, all of which have Vanessa living in the town in which Stone Angel is situated in Manitoba. Famous collection done in the... Actually, this is probably most close to home of Margaret Lawrence, but written last, latest in life. But Vanessa shows up in every one of them, about an 8 or 9-year-old girl living in the grandfather's house. Beautiful stories. Bird in the House is, when there is a bird in the house, someone's going to die, is the title story. And the other thing, The Tomorrow Tamer, the first thing Margaret Lawrence wrote, you know, there's a truism about writers that you have to leave where you are before you can distance it enough to write about it. She went off to Africa with her engineer husband in the early 50s, Margaret Lawrence did, and she wrote African stories called The Tomorrow Tamer. And if any of you are interested in that culture, she has captured beautifully.
Where did she go?
I couldn't say with certainty. I've got 2 in my mind. I'd rather not. I can't. I just can't come up with it. Tomorrow Tamer are those stories set in Africa. So, enough for Margaret Lawrence. Then there's Alice Munro. I'm not sure where she'd fit in terms of who made these analogies with biblical. Maybe she'd be Hannah. You could not say a word against Alice Munro and live in Canada. She's been writing short stories for the last 15 years. She won the Governor General's Award 3 times over. That is our major award, like your Pulitzer Prize. The first one was, Who Do You Think You Are? A collection of stories. She writes stories. Everything is a collection. Because of these two women and a few others, collections of stories are really sought after by publishers. It's usually hard to get them published, stories, as opposed to a novel. Who Do You Think You Are? I'm not going to finish that. Who Do You Think You Are? And Moons of Jupiter is the most recent. No, that's not true. Moons of Jupiter is the next to the last. She's been published in The New Yorker. Probably every second story appears first in The New Yorker and then ends up in a collection. Moons of Jupiter, and this is wonderful stuff. All my aunts are in this story, every single one of them. the country, the dusty road, the farm, the hay, everything is there. And she's got a wonderful one in Progressive Love is the last collection, which you should be able to find any place in the States. Progressive Love is got a wonderful one, Miles City, Montana. That's the title of it. So she's put Miles City on the map as well as Ontario. She writes mostly about Ontario. Margaret Lawrence, Central Manitoba, where you'll see a lot of things if you're from the Midwest that look familiar. Do you want any more? Am I keeping you too long? Joy Kogawa, I must tell you, Joy Kogawa is of Japanese descent, and Joy Kogawa, like that. And she wrote Obasan. Does anybody know that? Or Obasan? Yeah?
If you run it. Because you taught it, you left.
Oh,
I loved it.
I hope you can find it. Obasan means aunt. Joy Kogawa was third generation Japanese in 1941. Her father was an Anglican minister. When she was picked up and moved to the sugar beet fields of Alberta because she was a potential threat to the Canadian security, and you've got that story here too. She was the first one that put this into fiction, and probably her putting it into fiction got the government's face so red that they have begun doing things, whereas I think it's been a shame, an obvious shame in American history.
CBC read segments.
Read segments of this?
On an ongoing basis, day to day, and I remember hearing some of them if I tuned in at the right time.
This is, she's a poet, and this is so poetic, and by poetic I mean the use of language is so rich and careful that I couldn't read more than a couple of pages at the time the first time through. It's a story, in effect, she's taken a fictional way of telling the story of her being ripped out of Vancouver. Her mother went back to Japan to try to find the grandmother, and while there, the bomb was dropped. So there she is with Obasan, her aunt, in southern Alberta.
What I find interesting is that I mentioned to you on Monday a Mennonite writer who wrote Peace Shall Destroy Many, and he and she grew up in the same town. I mean, it just seems uncanny. This tiny little town in southern Alberta produced two of perhaps our most nationally known writers. When I get going, I feel like I've got a pulpit, and I feel I've got to save you all, for convert you all to Canadian fiction, and I'll stop in a minute. There's one more that's just interesting. Sheila Watson. This was written in the 50s. It's probably the most unusual. Sheila's still alive and living on a small island off BC, and she wrote The Double Hook, and it's the closest thing to a mythological, almost legend, set in Canada, but a legendary notion of, you know, the issues of life and death and birth and beauty. She's dealing with the larger things, not the particular characters. The Double Hook, it's called. But if you want to see something that is far away from issues of ethnicity and religion and history and so on, it would be Sheila's book, The Double Hook. Wonderful myth. I'm done. Any questions? I appreciate your
thank you. Thank
presence.
You.
Oh.